Hi, everybody. My name is Tim Hyland. I'm an alcoholic. And since April the 12th, 1990, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink of alcohol or other mood-altering substances. And that's been a good deal for me, y'all. Been a great deal, in fact. And I loved the little intro that you had, Gary. I was sitting thinking about that. I always remember, about people listening to our talks. And I heard Joe McQueenie tell a story one time that, you know, he was at a big AA conference back in the day, and he was out in the hall walking behind two ladies who weren't in the conference, and he overheard their conversation. And one lady said to the other one, "Well, what are they doing there anyway?" And this lady said, "Oh, it's awful." She said, "I peeked in there last night. One of them gets up there and says all these awful things about himself, and the rest of them laugh at him." You know, it always reminds me of how people from the outside, if they came in and listened to our talk, sometimes how they might view it. But anyway, I'm glad to be here. Billy, thanks for inviting me. Wow, I don't know when I was in Virginia the last time. It's been a while, but I know it was a really pleasant experience, and I had really great feelings about it. And like I said, this is what we're doing now, and I'm glad to be with you all tonight. You know, my sponsor is a little man that some of you probably know named Don M., and I've been really blessed to have him in my life, you know, for the last, you know, almost 22 years. And my home group, very much like yours, is called the Lambda Group. It's a three legacy home group. And like you all, we're on Zoom right now, 3 days a week, Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursday mornings. And, you know, I do miss the service part. I do miss that. We have a lot of newcomers in our group, and, you know, we try to keep them all busy and active, because I know for me, that was one of the best things in early sobriety, was keeping me busy and moving my feet and moving a chair every once in a while is the only thing I was capable of doing that really kept me sober. And, you know, I was just sitting there thinking, thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the one thing for sure I can appreciate today, you know, I don't know about you all, but we've had, you know, this is a really rough time around here in Louisville this year. And, you know, in addition to the normal chaos of the COVID, you know, we've had a lot of racial unrest. We had a lot of problems here, you know, with the protest, and just been, everything's been upside down. And, you know, we've almost gotten to a world, I think about when the election coming up this week, that, you know, it's either, you're either on one side or the other anymore, it seems like. And if it's kind of like, you know, if you're not on my side, then you're stupid. I hate you. And, you know, that's it. And thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Because thank God it's the only place I know I could come where nobody, we don't care if you're black or you're white. We don't care what your sexual orientation is. We don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican. We don't care. I mean, if you want to get sober, then you're always welcome in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you just can't find that too much anymore in this world. And I guess as I've gotten older, I'm really appreciating the love and the tolerance, you know, that I've been taught over the last 30 years, you know, in these rooms. And I appreciate it. Maybe I maybe I've taken it for granted a little bit, but I don't anymore. I certainly love, you know, showing up and being with you all. And, you know, I just kind of, you know, and you said it, you know, very clearly, you know, I've been doing a lot of different things. You know, there have been step workshops. There's a lot of different things that we do today, but, you know, I don't think anything ever replaces our stories. You know, this started with one man telling his story to another. And, you know, for the last 85 years, you know, that's how we've carried on the legacy of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as tired as I get of telling my story sometime, what Don has always told me is that, Timmy, that's, you know, that's your most valuable asset. You know, our asset, our most valuable asset is our horrible past. And, so I think it is always important somehow that, you know, we get our story told, and I'll try to go over that a little bit tonight. And, you know, I don't know if we have any new people here, but I always have to go back to when I came to AA, when I started out, I was really kind of focused on why I didn't belong there, or at least I was looking for a reason not to be there. And I think what I would do when I went to a speaker meeting, I would listen to what the speaker did that I didn't do, right? I'd, every night I'd try to pick that up. So I'd be listening to your talk and I'd think, well, I did that. Nope, I didn't do that. Didn't do that. Next night, next speaker, I did it. Nope, I didn't do that. And I think what I was doing, I thought, if I got enough didn'ts, I'm out of here. You know, but as God always has done with me, about 3 weeks into this, I'm at a meeting. A woman of all things is speaking, and everything this lady did, I did. And I'm sitting out there going, oh man, I did that. Oh, I'm screwed. I did that too. But then right at the end of her talk, she said she used to carry a half pint in her bra. I said, I did not do that. And I remember I told this old guy after the meeting about it, and he said, sounds like you're getting a little desperate there to me, kid. And I said, well, you know, I was kind of figuring out what an alcoholic looked like. And he said, well, kind of like you, actually. I said, well, no, you know what I mean, a dirty old man in a raincoat. And I looked at that meeting tonight. There were no dirty old men in raincoats at that meeting. It's kind of like tonight. I'm looking at the screen. I haven't seen a raincoat on here. Dirty old men everywhere, but no raincoats. Anyway, here's what happened. As I listened to your stories, it seemed to me what I heard almost all the time is that you all were talking about three things. You talked about being restless, irritable, and discontented. You talked about being apart from, not a part of. And you talked about progressive patterns of dishonesty in your life. And when I heard those three things, I was like, oh, man, I'm in trouble. Because those three things had been part of my life from the get-go. And honestly, those three things I've wrestled with right in the middle of AA for the last 30 years. You know, restless, irritable, discontent. Our book clearly talks about it. What is it? I can't tell you what it is, but I can tell you I have got it. I have had it for as long as I can remember. You know, and you can describe it any way you want to. You know, the knot in your gut or the hole in your belly that the wind blows through. All I know, when I was 15 years old and I put alcohol on that, it took it away. And for the next 27 years, when restless, irritable, and discontent came, I took a drink. I mean, it was going to be my solution for what I know today as a spiritual malady that I had no idea what it was, nor did I care. I was just very happy that I had found this thing called alcohol, which seemed to take care of it just fine. Thank you. The second thing you all were talking about was being apart from, not a part of. And oh man, you know, even at 30 years sober today, there's still a little part of me that wants to be different. There's still a little piece of me that wants to separate from the pack. And I don't know what that's all about, you know, but I do know it's part of my disease. I do know it's part of what's wrong with me. And one of the most valuable things that you all told me was, Tim, look, you just keep coming back, irregardless of what you feel, think, or believe. Because as Don has explained to me, he said, Timmy, your feelings, thoughts, and beliefs are your disease. And thank God for that, because I need to tell you, many times early on in AA, and sometimes even today, I don't feel good about it. I don't think it's going to work, and I don't understand it. But I do the simple actions anyway. And thank God for that, because if it had been about me having to feel good about it, understand it, and even believe it was going to work, I wouldn't be here. And thank God, you know, we, as long as we take those simple steps that we're asked to do, you know, that it will work. The other thing, the last thing you were talking about was having progressive patterns of dishonesty in your life. And one of the things I knew about me was that I lied when the truth was good enough my whole life. You know, I was even conscious of it. Like when I was a teenage kid, I was a good athlete. But if I scored 20 points in a game and I came home, you'd say, how many points you'd score? I'd say 25. You know, got a B on the test. What'd you get, Tim? B+. And I remember thinking, why do I do that? Why isn't the truth good enough for me? And, you know, I really look back and I think somehow I intuitively knew that the truth wasn't going to work for a guy like me. Somehow I knew I had to get outside the truth and stay outside the truth if I wanted to act the way I wanted to act and eventually drink the way I wanted to drink, you know. You know, I always tell this little story. I was about 3 months sober and I got back with my family. My wife took me back and one night I was sitting up with my 13-year-old daughter and, you know, 12:45 in the morning, I can't sleep because I'm 3 months sober. She can't sleep because she's 13, you know. So all of a sudden she says to me, Dad, can I order a pizza? I said, honey, it's 12:45 in the morning. Don't do that. Your mother will go crazy. She said, oh, come on, let me. I said, all right, go ahead. So she ordered the pizza about 1:15 in the morning. Doorbell rang. Here comes her mother flying out of the bedroom, screaming at her, what are you doing getting a pizza at 1:15 in the morning? And my daughter said, well, Dad said I could. My wife said, you said she could. I said, nope. My daughter said, Dad, you are lying. I said, I know it, man. I do it all the time. And, you know, I say all that to say this. You know, those three things, restless, irritable, and discontent, apart from, not a part of, and progressive patterns of dishonesty in my life, what I know today that I didn't know when I showed up here over 30 years ago was what I just described as this physical, spiritual, and mental malady called alcoholism and everything that goes with it. You know, a disease of body, of mind, and of spirit. Restless, irritable, and discontent. And here's the good news. AA said, hey, we got it all covered. Tim, that restless, irritable, discontent, taking a drink, we're going to hook you up with a new power. And when you have that feeling, you go to that power instead of going to that bottle. Apart from, not a part of, we're going to give you the great fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all you got to do is drag your raggedy old butt in here every day. And Tim, the thing about lying, we're going to have you do the 12 steps. And if you do those steps, we promise you, you'll find your truth. You'll be able to accept that truth and you're going to live sober and going to be happy. And hey, Tim, by the way, you can't do any of that by yourself. You know, Don, my sponsor, always says you can throw him in the closet with a big book and say, get well, and it ain't going to happen. Got to have you guys. You know, the wonderful thing about those spiritual principles, you know, we like to claim them in AA, you know, they kind of been around a long time, you know, trust God, clean house, help others, you know, Bill put them in 12 steps, but the concepts have kind of been there for a while. The magic of AA was when you took those 12 spiritual principles and you got one alcoholic eyeball to eyeball with another, the magic happened. You know, and that's why I need you. This is right away was a program that I kind of wanted to do myself, but it didn't take me long to realize that that wasn't going to work. You know, I had tried to do something for myself for years and years and years, and the best I could do was end up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, I share this with you. And, you know, so what I'm saying is the good news is that it's all here. The total solution is right here. The problem with a guy like me is I tend to want to do things halfway. I tend to want to do things partially. If you tell me this is 100% of what you need to do, I start thinking immediately a guy like me could probably get by with 80%, you know? A guy like me, surely I don't have to go to a meeting every day. I could pick this stuff pretty quick. Just give me the pamphlets and let me read them and I'll get it done, okay? And for the first 14 months, that's kind of what I did, you know, and I almost drank and I almost killed myself in that first 14 months. But you know, you guys, I came from a Irish Catholic family here in the West End of Louisville. And you know what? It wasn't if you were going to drink in my family, it was when and how good were you going to do it, right? It was a way of life, you know. If you came to my dad's front door, he offered you something to drink. You know, I mean, just the way it was. I mean, we had the mailman come in there. You know, we had all the delivery boys. You know, of course, the priests and the nuns, they were no problem. We lived right behind the Catholic Church. We even had a Jehovah's Witnesses up on the corner, and he almost had those guys in one night for a couple beers. They didn't quite get in, but he almost had them. But my point is that it was around, and I guess my thought was, you know, alcohol worked for me before I ever tasted it. And what I mean is I was the oldest of seven kids. And, you know, my daddy was one of those drunks that if he didn't stop at the tavern, you know, we knew what was showing up at home, right? Restless, irritable, and discontent. And I remember we'd be sitting at the kitchen table and I'd watch him come in with that look on his face like he's going to kill somebody. But then he'd reach up and get that Yellowstone whiskey, and he'd pop him a big old hit of that. And he'd grab a can of beer and knock it all the way back and go, bup, 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 and his head would go, and I was sitting over there watching him going, wow, I don't know what happened there, but I'm in. I am in. Guy told me one time, Tim, if you're catching a buzz at 10 years old watching people drink, you're probably going to have a problem. And the reason I say that is when I got to AA and read the big book, you guys said, hey, this stuff does something entirely different for you than it does for normal people. And I didn't, you know, I didn't know that. I didn't care. And I basically hung around people who it did for them exactly what it did for me. But anyway, that was important to know that, it did something different physically. Cause as I went on, you know, with my drinking, that whole part about the first drink being the problem was really going to be an issue for me. But anyway, you know, I'll share this with you that, you know, in the state of Kentucky, as you guys probably know, if you can shoot a basketball through a hoop, that's a big deal here. And, especially when I was a kid, and you know, that was my dream. My childhood dream was to go to a Division I college to play basketball. And that's all I ever practiced. That's all I ever did. That's all I ever cared about. And sure enough, you know, I became an all-city player, an all-state player in high school, got a number of offers from colleges, and I ended up going to St. Louis University, which at that time played in the same league with Louisville and Cincinnati and Memphis State. I mean, it was the old Missouri Valley Conference. And so my dream came true, you know, and I left here in 1966 in all my glory to follow my dream. Alcohol and alcoholism jumped up in my life so quick that by the first game of my sophomore year, in those days you couldn't play as freshmen like you can now, but the first day of my game of my sophomore year, I showed up to the game so drunk that the other players had to hide me down on the end of the bench so they wouldn't throw me out of school. So this is like going to watch Virginia Tech or UVA, and on the end of the bench, one of the kids is drunk. And what happened that day was going to happen to me over and over. I was walking down the street after class. A guy said, hey, you want to get a beer? I said, oh, yeah. I always said yeah, because I had a mind that would always go something like, all right, I'll go have a couple beers, come back, get a nap, get up, take a shower, go to the game. Probably be the hero. You know, that's what my mind would do. I'm 18. I don't know anything about a physical allergy or mental obsession. And I certainly didn't know anything about phenomenon of craving. And as you probably imagine, I didn't. I drank right up to game time, stumbled in that men's locker room, and there's nothing more obvious than a drunk in a men's sterile locker room. You know, thank God the guys got to me before the coach did. But the significance of that was, I just told you that was the most important thing in my life. And that day, alcohol went right by it. And from that day forward, alcohol would dictate on a daily basis what I did, who I did it with, and especially where I ended up on any given day. Alcohol was driving the bus, you know. Of course, I had no idea, you know. You know, one of the problems, I think, with this whole disease is we're always kind of the last to know. But anyway, it went by that, and it was going to go by everything from that point on that I would ever care about. My marriage, my kids, my jobs, it didn't matter. Alcohol was always going to end up in first place. It always had a way to work its way to the top of the of my ledger. But anyway, so I played basketball through the first 3 years. I got hurt. I couldn't play my senior year. And the sad part about it is, as I look back, I didn't even care, you know. The most important thing in my life, I spent, you know, my whole life trying to achieve, I didn't care anymore. I had found something more exciting. I had found this alcohol and the way of life that went with it. I loved it. I loved the bars. I loved the excitement. You know, it was just, I was off and running. So I went through my senior year, came to the end of my senior year, and I had to graduate. And I say that because I kind of wanted to stay there if I could, because I wanted to keep the party going. Because in 1970, some of you are my age, there was a thing called the Vietnam War going on, and that was not going real great in 1970. Plus, they had a thing called the lottery, where they drew your birthday out of a hat to see when you're getting drafted. I was like number 6 out of 365, you know. I made the top 10, so I am going. Now, if you're a vet, I want to say to you, you know, I wasn't going to run to Canada. I mean, I wasn't brought up like that. I would go if I had to, but it certainly wasn't high on my priority list. I'll tell you that. Now, there were two ways you could get deferred from the draft. You could get married. I thought, oh man, that's awful drastic. Or you could go to grad school. And I thought, well, that's it. That's exactly what I need to do. And you guys, I came up with a plan at that point in time, and I want to say to you, this is embarrassing, how it went through my mind, but some of you might identify. I was a political science major, been pretty much a street drunk for the last 3.5 to 4 years. But the plan I came up with for grad school was this. I'm going to go take the test to get into law school. I'm going to pass that test. I'm going to get into law school. I'm going to graduate from law school, and then someday I'm going to run for Congress and someday President of the United States. It's a short trip for me from street drunk to President of the United States. You know, I mean, I can get there like that. And anyway, I got a terrible score on the LSAT and the law school, excuse me. Law school turned me down. And now, as meager as it may sound to you guys now, I mean, I was in a panic. Because I'm thinking, Tim, you better come up with a new plan or you're going to be over shooting them up pretty quick, brother. And it hits me. Tim, stop drinking. Stop drinking and study for the test because you got the brains to get into law school, for God's sakes. So for the next 5 weeks, you guys, I don't drink a drop. And it was awful. You know, I had got through the shakes for about 3 or 4 days. Everybody's out partying in the spring. I found this real smart guy down the hall, and he tutored me every day on how to take this LSAT test. 5 weeks, dry on the bone, I gave it the best I could. It came down to the day before the second test. I made a little change to the plan. I thought, you know what? I'm ready. I'm going to go out and have a couple beers so I can relax. Come back, get up, get a good night's sleep, take that test, pass that test, get into law school, Congress, President of the United States. Same plan, one little upfront change if you paid attention. I left on Friday afternoon for those two beers. I didn't get back to that campus till the following Tuesday. Found out I rode around St. Louis on a city bus about a day and a half of what I know today is called a blackout. And honest to God, I did not know what a blackout was when I got to AA. I did know. I used to start somewhere, end up somewhere else with a big old chunk of time missing, and I didn't think a whole lot about it. And if you're new, I just want to say, if that's happening in your life, that is not right. And, you know, I always think God started to have fun with me about this time, because about 2 in the morning, it hits me and I'm drunk. I'm not taking the test, but I went back to the dormitory and I found a real smart guy who was tutoring me, and I paid him $25 to go take that test for me. And I'm really not proud of that, but back in those days, that's just where I was. And also, it was a lot easier to do that back then. So this guy goes and takes the test in my name. I stayed drunk for 3 days. I even forgot he took the test. 3 weeks later, we got the results of the test the guy took in my name. The guy got the highest score in the history of the law school. Oh, man, it was not funny then, I want to tell you. I remember opening that envelope and thinking, you idiot. God, look what you've done to me now, man. I don't know what the numbers were. Let's say 800 was perfect. He got 799. I had gotten like 350 on the one I took. So and I got two scores over there, 400 points apart. And I thought, man, I better get to them before they get to me. And I made an appointment to go see the dean of the law school, and here I am now, 23 years old, Mr. Hero Child, Mr. All-State basketball player. 4 short years later, I'm standing in front of the dean, lying through my teeth, saying, Dean, you're probably wondering about the difference in them two scores. Hey, listen, I decided I didn't want to be a lawyer. I let some other guy take the test. How did he do anyway? And I knew he knew I was lying. But what I wanted to share with you is I turned to leave the office that day. I don't know why this happened. So I turned to leave the office. It went through my mind. It was, Tim, you know what the problem is, man. It's the booze. The booze took the basketball, and the booze took your chance to go to law school, because you should be doing both of them, and you know it. And for that moment, it was that clear. It just didn't last very long, right? I turned and walked out of that office. there were two guys that I know. He said, "Hey, you want to get a drink?" I said, "Yeah, you bet. I need a drink. This guy really screwed up." You know, recently I found that guy, and he lives in Kansas City, and I was able to contact him and make amends to that man for putting him in that position. You know, nothing happened, but I certainly did put him in jeopardy. But anyway, you know, that was 1970, you all. It was going to be 20 years until I showed up into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'll tell you what, in those four short years even, alcohol and alcoholism took from me some of the very things I would fight you over today. You know, took my dignity, took my integrity, took my security, took my confidence in myself. It took my whole sense of purpose in my life away. And I say that because I didn't realize that at the time, but over the last 30 years, you all have kind of helped give me those things back. And those things are important to all of us, you know, call it moral fiber, call it whatever you want. But that had already been stripped. So I guess basically I'm not 23 years old and I'm already spiritually bankrupt and going to go back and try to start my adult life. So, of course, I had to go back to Louisville. I took the draft physical. I flunked the draft physical on a congenital birth defect. I thought, man, that has saved me a lot of trouble. Oh, man. And I started, I had to live with my mom and dad, right? And I got into teaching and coaching because I had a degree and I played ball. So this first job I got, I was the dean of students at an all-boys Catholic high school, which means that school hired a drunk to be in charge of discipline at their school is what that means. My job was to check these kids in every morning, make sure that they were on time. And I'm going to tell you just one quick story, you'll understand why I'm telling you. One morning, as usual, I was sitting there hungover, a big old tomato head, and, you know, just trying to get to 9 o'clock in the morning. And this is back in the 70s, right, where all the kids were out in the parking lot hitting a few doobies to get ready for class. And I look up one day, and this kid standing up over me had that long hair we had in the 70s. He had his army jacket on. You could smell that reefer everywhere, and he was just floating over the top of my desk like this. And all of a sudden, he looked down and went, "Hey, Mr. Hyland, you're looking bad, dude." And I forgot what I said that day. But what I wanted to share with you, that kid that said that to me that day, this past July, celebrated 37 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's a multimillionaire, lives down in Destin, Florida, and he's a great member of AA. And I went down there a couple years ago to speak, and he met me with his kids, and he ran over and said, "Hey, coach, look, come here." He said, "I ain't never told my kids how I was." He said, "I'll make you a deal. You don't say anything about me, I won't say anything about you." And let me tell you, one of the great joys I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous, guess where a lot of those boys I tried to teach and coach have showed up? Right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've got the sponsors, some of the same guys I tried to teach and coach back in the 70s. And, you know, it wasn't a fun time. It was an ugly time. You know, showing up to parent-teacher conferences drunk, showing up to coach basketball games drunk, not good. You know, it was some really, really ugly things. But it was just where I was. It was just where I was with my whole disease. And it was just starting to get going then. Because what happened was I decided, you know, I needed to do something better with my life. And like every good drunk, I had to start my own business, right? I had to do it myself. So I started my insurance business in 1980. And let me tell you this too. I'd be remiss not to go over this part of my story, but, also, you know, I had met my high school sweetheart when we were seniors in high school, and we dated for about 6 months, and then I went off to St. Louis. She stayed in Louisville. And so for the next 4 years, it was kind of, you know, on and off, love the one you're with type of deal, right? Well, by the time you heard the law school debacle, we had been broken up for 8 months. I hadn't even seen her. So I'm back home living with mom and dad, and I was out one night, and I ran into her. Man, did she look good. I mean, she looked really good. And she was driving this little yellow sports car, and I stopped and talked to her, and she told me about this great job she had. She told me about this great apartment she was living in, and I thought, you know what? I think I'm falling in love here. That was like in August, and we got married in November of 1970. Didn't want to rush it, you know, and hang on here. We got married November 1970. We got divorced in 1983. We got remarried in 1985, divorced in 1987, and remarried in 1990 when I got sober. But then we got divorced again in 1995. Now, you know, this always is amazing. If I told the people in my office that, they'd go, "What? I just shared that with you guys and you hardly flinched." What is that all about? Well, I can tell you today, it's all about alcohol, alcoholism, and everything that goes with it. I love him. I hate him. I hate him. I love him. He's good. He's bad. He's bad. He's good. If you don't know, there's a thing called alcoholism in the middle of any relationship. Pretty much an impossible deal, right? And actually, what you had there were two people that actually cared for each other. They had no idea what we were dealing with, drunk or sober. And that's why I have a big, big place in my heart for Al-Anon. Because, you know, if there ever was a family disease, you all, this is it, right? Everybody around us gets really, really neurotic, gets really, really sick. But anyway, you know, then when I started the business, and let me tell you a little about the 80s. The 80s was the decade before where I got sober in 1990. Not a good decade. Already told you, got divorced in 83, remarried in 85, divorced in 87, remarried in 90. I was engaged to two other women in the 80s. I was in the nut house three different times. I had 14 different places I lived. I had 12 different business partners. I got shot at twice. I got cut with a beer bottle and I lost $250,000. And I was thinking, this is going okay. This is going okay. We're always like the last to know, man. I don't know what that's all about. But anyway, from 1982 to 1985, I went through five psychiatrists. That was a simple deal. I kept them until they started talking about alcohol. If he talked about alcohol, fired them, got me a new guy. I mean, I was taking every antidepressant they ever made in the 80s, drinking whiskey and beer every day. And if you're using that recipe, it didn't work real great for me. You know, New Year's Eve, 1985, back with mom and dad. You know, I used to run the guys I went to high school with. They'd say, "Hey, man, what are you doing?" I said, "I'm president of my own company." They'd say, "No kidding. Where are you living?" I said, "With mom and dad." Doesn't match up, does it? Unless you're an Alcoholics Anonymous. But anyway, New Year's Eve, 1985, I woke up in my mom and dad's house, and it was a crazy day. For that day, no matter how much whiskey I drank, the thrill was gone. The thrill was gone, and I think maybe some of you understand what I'm saying. No matter how much I drank that day, I knew it was never, ever going to work for me the way I remember that it worked. You know, the book talks about we get to a point where we can't live with it and we can't live without it. And that's kind of where I was. And I was as suicidal as I've ever been. Didn't know what to do with that even. But my brother Tommy drove me up to our asylum called Our Lady of Peace, which sits up on a little hill. And he dropped me off there. Now, I told you, I was as down. I was as, you know, suicidal as I've ever been. But this is my alcoholism in a bucket. They put me in this little room, and this nurse comes in, sits next to me, as I remember, and she says, "Honey, tell me about it. What's going on?" I said, "All right, I'll tell you about it." 2 years ago, my first wife threw me out for no reason that I could think of. Then I got engaged to this other woman, and she took off with a ring, and I haven't even paid for it. Oh, yeah, did I tell you? My daddy went to prison when I was 12, and I don't know where this stuff was coming from, but I just kept sharing. And you know what? The longer I shared, the better I felt. I looked at the nurse after a while. She didn't look so good. But maybe I'm here an hour and a half. This lady looks at me and says, "Honey, you certainly have a right to feel the way you do." And I was like, "God, lady, you're so right. What the hell was I thinking? If people messed over you like they messed over me, by God, you'd drink and be depressed too." You know, I wasn't in there 2 hours, you all, and I went from suicide to figuring out it wasn't me, it was you guys. And if I would just get around the right people, I would be fine. I spent the next 16 days that time in the in the nut house trying to help everybody else. They made me head of the stress class. I got a blue ribbon for the best ceramic in the shop thing. I mean, I was killing it in there. I was doing so well, the nurse said to me one day about halfway through my stay, you're doing great. If you want to go out for a couple hours, as long as you're back by curfew, that'll be fine. I said, well, thank you very much. I thought they're finally starting to understand who they're dealing with here. I call my best buddy. He picks me up to the night house. Of course, we go right to the watering hole. Slam down 6-8 beers. Got a couple shots. I bought this big old bottle of wine. I was telling about all the people I'm helping back the hospital. We just got trashed. 10:45, I said, hey, you got to get me back to the nut house. I got curfew. He drives me back there, and I'm staggering out, you know, the passenger door to go back in there. And I look back, and my buddy's just bawling. He's just got tears coming all down his face. I said, what is wrong with you? He said, Tim, you don't belong in there. I do. And I think I said something like, you know what? I think you're right. And when I get out of here, I will help you. And you guys, I came out of there and I did what I always did. I started over, got me a new girlfriend, got me a new place to live, got me a new business partner. I was always starting over. And in fact, if you listen to our stories in AA, we are the best starter overs in the world. Can't finish much of anything. We flat start over, baby. I came out of there. I got back with my most frequent wife, as I call her, and we tried hard. We bought a new house. We changed everything that we could. But as the old guys would always tell me, Timmy, wherever you go, there you are. And the drunk was still in the middle of the room, right? And I spent my last 6 months in 1989 of drinking, living in the guy's basement out in the south end of Louisville. And I can't tell you anything spectacular happened there. I can tell you April 12th of 1990, I staggered into that house about 2 o'clock in the morning. The family I was living with was already asleep, of course. I stood on the edge of the bed and I drank the last 3 beers he had in his refrigerator and watched ESPN go off the air, which tells you how long ago that was. And I had the craziest feeling I've ever had. You know, I got all prickly. I was all clammy. I remember thinking I might be having a heart attack. And I guess I passed out in my clothes on the bed, woke up about 5 the next morning. Same crazy feeling, clammy, prickly. And I remember thinking, maybe I should go to the emergency room. But then I got up and I started toward the shower and I just broke down, just completely broke down. You know, and the truth hit me. The truth was, Tim, you've lost your wife again. You've lost your home again. You've lost your business partner again. And I just wept. And I said, God, I am so sick and tired of this. You know, please show me a different way. I got my shower and I got dressed and I went in my office. And you guys, I'm in a business that's very busy. Usually the phone rings all day. Usually people are in and out of my office all day. April 12th of 1990, I sat down at 7:45. I didn't move a muscle till noon. The phone never rang one time that day and nobody came into the office. You know, the book talks about a moment of clarity, and I guess that was mine, because I remember all I could think about is it's over. And I remember thinking, what's over? I didn't know what was over. It just had this sense of being over. And I reached in my desk drawer. There's a meeting directory of Alcoholics Anonymous, which a guy had given me 2.5 years before. And I went to my first meeting that day. And I'll tell you what, from that day until tonight, 30 plus years, you guys, what a ride it has been. I have to tell you, some days I've laughed so hard, I think my guts are going to pop out. But I also have to tell you, over the last 30 years, I have cried more tears than I thought a man like me would ever cry. And I have felt grief and agony and fear like I didn't think I could handle. And the reason I always mention that, when I was newly sober, I was really hoping that this sobriety thing was going to be about the absence of problems in little Timmy's life. And you guys said, oh, no, little Timmy, who told you that? Here's what sobriety is, little Timmy. You're going to get to be part of life. And Tim, you're going to get to be there in body, mind, and spirit. And when you said that, the bell went off. Because my wife used to say to me back in the day, Tim, you're not even here when you're here. And I'd get so mad. I said, can't you see? I'm sitting right here. But then I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, I have a threefold disease, a body, mind, and spirit. And what I came to realize, if you can only bring your body and you can't bring your mind and you can't bring your soul, you are just a body in the room. you know, my disease was really, I was either drinking, I was thinking about drinking, or I was thinking about me. And that means everybody out. That's alcoholism at the max. And I say that because it all of a sudden I realize why there's 12 steps and just not three and a third. Because I was going to have consequences because of the other parts of my disease. I did not realize how debilitating and harmful my disease can be even when I didn't have the booze in me. Even without the booze, because I was so self-centered and my behavior as such didn't change for a while. And as such, I had consequences at 5 years sober. I had consequences at 10 years sober. But the good news is, you know, I didn't drink. The good news is I always kept a drunk in front of me, which is the one thing in 30 years that if I've done one thing, I've always kept another drunk close by, another drunk to help. And somehow I've stumbled and bumbled and fallen down, but I've always been able to find another drunk to help pick me up. But anyway, you know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't do it right, you guys. First 14 months, as I said earlier, I didn't have a sponsor, didn't have a home group, certainly hadn't gotten near a step. And I was super angry. I had a lot of anger. And I was in a meeting one night, and this old guy said, "What are you so angry about?" And I said, "I'll shut up," or something like that. He said, "See me after the meeting." So I see this guy after the meeting. He said, "Why are you so angry?" I said, "I don't know." I said, "I can't even go to sleep at night, man. I haven't slept in days." He said, "All right, Tim, I want you to lay there tonight and just go, 'God is love, God is love, God is love,' until you fall asleep." And I did that in early sobriety, and sometime I would fall asleep. I do that today sometimes. But I'm 14 months drier than a bone, and God is love was not getting it done. And I remember specifically thinking, if I call that guy today and he tells me God is love one more time, I'm going to knock him out. And sure enough, I called him, and sure enough, he said, "Tim, just remember, God is love." I said, "Man, I know that, but I'm so angry, and I'm so depressed." The guy started to chuckle. He went, "Good, good, 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 good." I said, "What do you mean good?" He said, "Tim, an Alcoholics Anonymous, God is love, but love is action. God is love, steps 1, 2, and 3, your powerlessness, his power. Steps 4 through 9, your simple responsibility to clean up your mess. Step 10 is a refresher course every day. Step 11 hooks you up with your God. And step 12 hooks you up with us. What do you say, Tim? Are you ready?" I said, "Yes, sir, I'm ready, because I'm either going to kill myself or I'm going to kill you." And that was the day he sent me down to Lambton Baptist Church, and I became the coffee maker there on Wednesday morning. And that was the day he put me into a men's big book group that to this very day meets every Wednesday night from 5:45 to 7. And that was the day, you all, I found out the greatest secret in AA, I think. You know what that is? I found out where the fun is. The fun is in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in the middle where people are doing the deal. They're getting there early. They're staying late. They're putting up the chairs. They're giving people rides. They work in committees and conferences. Those people are having a ball. And from that day forward, I've never wanted to be out of the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not back out there on the edge with 1 foot in and 1 foot out where I was. It was the most miserable, dangerous spot I've ever known in my life. You know, also let me share this piece with you. As you probably heard, when I got to AA, I owed $250,000 to people who really wanted it back. And I thought, that's very rude of them. I'm trying to get sober, and all these people can think about is their money, for God's sakes. And but anyway, it was a mess. And every day I'd go into my office and start thinking about what I was going to do about that. And I'd start shuffling papers from one side of my desk to the other. That self-centered fear would start to grasp me. And by 10:30, I was back in my apartment, crawled up in a ball. I mean, it was paralyzing. So one night again, I'm at a meeting whining about this, and this old man says, "See me after the meeting, will you?" So I see this guy after the meeting. He said, "What are you whining about?" I said, "Well, I owe people all this money, and they're bothering me, and I'm probably going to have to bankrupt." And he said, "Tell me about your business." I said, "What do you want to know?" He said, "Just tell me about it." I said, "Okay, well, we open at 8 o'clock. He said, good, Tim, be there at 8 o'clock. Not 8:05 or 8:10. Tim, you be there at 8. Okay. What's next? I said, well, I'll go on sales calls. He said, good, go on your sales calls. What's next? I said, well, I'll go to lunch. He said, good, Tim, go to lunch, and Tim, come back from lunch. I thought, that's a good point. What's next? I said, well, I'll come in and do my paperwork. What's next? I said, well, work's over at 4:45. He said, good, Tim, go home. Have dinner with your family. Go to your meeting. Come home. Say your prayers. And then he ripped me. He said, and Tim, do the same thing the next day. I was like, wow, like you do that every day, huh? And what that guy was telling me, my sponsor Don has given it a name. He was telling me, Timmy, your job is to do the stitches and leave the patterns up to God. You just do the stitches, son, and leave the patterns up to God. You know, but my problem is, you all, when I start thinking about stitching, I start thinking, okay, what am I making here? Is this a shirt? Is it a hat? Is it pants? And when's it going to be done? And he said, no. You just stitch and trust that God will take care of that. So I started doing that, you guys. I'm going, this is the stupidest thing I've ever done. But I got there at 8. I went on sales calls. I went to lunch. I came back from lunch. And I did it every day for about 6 weeks. And it wasn't working. I looked at my bank account. I still owe $249,270. And I'm thinking, this is a slow boat. But I kept doing it. Let me tell you the sequel to the story real quick. About 5 years later, I came into my office one morning. There were 6 phone messages. 5 AA guys, of course. And then the last one was from a reporter at the business paper here in Louisville. So I called this lady. She said, Mr. Highland, we'd like to do an article on your business as one of the fastest growing of its kind in the Louisville area. And of course, I went, oh, well, thank you. I'm very honored. I said, that's very, very, very nice. I said, ma'am, what is it you'd like to know? She said, sir, what was it that you did that really turned your business around? And you all, I had this one story. I came up with this great idea, pulled myself up by my bootstraps and rocketed this company to success. But that ain't what I said. I said, lady, here's the deal. My office opens at 8. I get there at 8. I go on my sales calls. I come back from sales calls. I go to lunch. I come back from lunch. I went through the whole thing. And when I was done, there was like silence on the other end of the phone. She said, thank you, sir. We'll see what we can do. And I knew there wasn't going to be an article, but I knew this. I knew I had told her exactly the truth of my life. You know, Don tells me, Timmy, you ask God each morning for the divine inspiration. What's the next stitch in my AA life? The next stitch in my personal life and the next stitch in my business life. And you know what? The stitch is always right there. The problem with me, I'm a big deal guy, right? That when I'm just stitching and not worrying about the pattern, you know, it's the best it ever is for me. You know, let me share this with you. We laugh in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot about relationships and our inability to do it very well. And I don't know that we're any worse at relationships than normal people. Yeah, we are. Yeah, we're probably a lot worse. But anyway, none of that was very funny, right? When you lose your marriage when you're drinking is one thing. Losing it sober, oh, it was really painful. You know, when I lost my marriage at 5 years sober, I was crushed, you know, just crushed because I thought I was doing everything I could do. But it didn't work. And I came to you guys and you guys said, oh, Tim, we don't know, buddy, but just keep helping drunks, you know, just keep helping drunks. And I did that, you know, I just kept helping drunks. So I'm helping drunks 1 year. I'm helping drunks in the second year. And then I got to thinking, God, I don't mind helping drunks, but I'd certainly like to have a female partner to help drunks with, if you don't mind. And bam, it was like a miracle. There she was, right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you, on paper, it looked like one of the best AA relationships of all time. She was 5 years more sober than me. She was involved. I was involved. And so we dated the mandatory 3 months and got married. The marriage lasted 8 months. And when it went down in flames right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was embarrassing for both of us. And by the way, we have made amends to each other and we're good friends today. Well, we're friends today. I don't know if we're good friends. But anyway, it was hurtful. It was very hurtful. And I want to tell you, now I'm almost 10 years sober. And I'm on my knees thinking, God, what is so broken in me? What is so wrong with me that I can't have a decent relationship with somebody? And I came to you guys, and as always, you said, oh, Timmy, we don't know, buddy, but just keep helping them drunks. You'll be all right. Thank God for that peace, huh? But I need to share this with you. A strange thing happened on my way to long-term celibacy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Of course, I was living back with my dad again at 10 years sober because I'd lost my house. And I got a call one day. And it was, remember, my mother and my children, my most frequent wife, she was down in South Carolina. And she had the kids down there and the grandkids on a vacation. And I guess she heard about what happened, and she said, would you like to come down here and spend some time with the kids? And I said, yeah, I would appreciate that. So I drove down to South Carolina, got a separate condo from where they were staying. We had been, keep in mind, we had been divorced for 6 years this last time. But here are two people, been married, I mean, met when we were 17 years old, been married and divorced three times. I think we were 52 years old at the time. And on that particular trip to South Carolina, for whatever reason, we agreed to be friends and work on a friendship. And we agreed to be parents and co-parents and work on both of our parenting and our grandparenting. And you know, the walls that just weren't so, always too high for us, didn't seem quite as high. There was more of an ease and comfort. And that was nice. So we came back to Louisville, and I started to date her because we never dated. We just kind of got married a lot, you know, and, I took her out every Friday night for about 6 months. And then I finally sold the house that I had and I moved in with her. And just about 18 years ago, 2002, I was sitting there. She was sitting there. I looked at her. She looked at me. I said, well, what do you think? This coming November 28th, you guys, will be our 50th gross wedding anniversary. I'm not sure what the net is. I think it's around 43, but we're going with the gross. We got married in 1970. We're going with 50 in 2020. Let me share this with you. As crazy as that sounds, and it is crazy. And I asked Don, my sponsor, I said, Don, is this pretty nuts? He goes, yeah, it's pretty nuts. But then he said, Timmy, maybe not. You know why? If our program's about anything, it's about transformation. And you know the thing about transformation? We don't know when it's going to happen. We don't know how it's going to look. And we don't know who's going to be involved. You know why? Because we don't transform. God does. My friend Bob up in Minneapolis says, you know, we plant the seed. We keep the weeds away from it and we water it. But we don't grow it. God grows it when he's ready to grow it. And I have to tell you all, that has to be what happened here. We are the best of friends. We are so in love. I hate not being with her, you know, and I look at that sometimes, and all I know that, you know, God could and would if he were sought. I couldn't do it. She couldn't do it. But somewhere in all that craziness, somewhere along the way, sticking with the 12 steps and coming back to those day after day after day, somewhere along the line, there was a transformation, not only in me, but in her, that allowed us to be together today. And I don't understand how that works. I don't need to. You know, one lady one time told me, she listened to my talk and she said, Tim, sound like you always thought you came to a period in your life. I said, yeah, I had a lot of periods. She said, no, Tim, God doesn't use periods. He only uses commas. He only uses commas. And if you think you're at a period in your life right now, you're wrong. There's a comma there. The problem is God didn't share with us what's behind that comma. We have to suit up and show up every day. And as our book says, to stay on the firing line of life and be ready to help God's kids when they come forward. And thank God, you know, I was able to do that. You know, I'll finish up. I'm kind of out of time, but, you know, I have a sober daughter today. I have a sober nephew. I have a sober brother. And all those things only became possible because one day at a time, you know, I didn't take a drink of alcohol. And I stumbled into the rooms of AA many times, not understanding what was going on, not feeling it was going to work. And certainly not believing in it. But because for some reason you guys asked me to do certain things, I continued to do those. And so anytime, anywhere today, when I'm asked to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, the answer is always going to be yes. I don't have to understand, but I know, as the book told me, you know, there is a power. There is a power. It's not me, but I've been around long enough to see that power in other people. Just like I can see it, you know, in you all tonight being here, and I'm very grateful for that. So thanks for letting me join you all tonight, and I love everybody, and God bless you guys.